This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Natural Resources Defense Council. Using science, the law, and people power, NRDC is committed to confronting the climate crisis, protecting public health, and safeguarding nature. They address the impact of fossil fuels on communities and our environment. They help protect wildlife, public lands, and irreplaceable ecosystems that all living things depend on. They work to enact policies for clean air, clean water, and access to nature for all. You can help NRDC safeguard the Earth for future generations. Visit nrdc.org/WNYC for more information.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and I'm Kelly Fasene. I'm a staff writer here at the New Yorker, and I'm sitting in today for David Remnick. A little later in the hour, we'll hear from Bono, the lead singer of U2, in a live interview about his new memoir, Surrender. But first, we're going to talk politics. Lots of people are nervous about the midterm elections. Americans are so polarized now that governing is impossible. We hear this kind of thing all the time. Francis Suarez doesn't buy it. Suarez is the Republican mayor of Miami. He's popular in the city and increasingly prominent beyond it. He's the president of the U.S. Conference of Mayors, and not long ago the columnist George Will mentioned him as a potential presidential candidate. Nikki Haley was said to be considering him as a possible running mate. But Suarez is a proudly dissident Republican. He loves tech companies, and he thinks his party can lead the fight to tackle climate change. So, is he actually a Republican at all?
What's the word?
Mr. Mayor.
What's happening?
Last week, I caught up with him from his office in Miami. So, your father, Xavier Suarez, was elected mayor of Miami a few weeks after your 8th birthday, if I have that right.
That's right.
Did he talk city politics at the dinner table?
Yes. City politics was a constant conversation at dinner table, the breakfast table, the basketball court, everywhere we went. You get to see the person behind the scenes and all the nitty-gritty little decisions that people don't often see. I remember cable was licensed through the city. And I remember one time coming home and we had all the channels, mysteriously, right? We had like HBO, Showtime.
That's the dream, man.
And so I went to my dad. I was like, oh my God, this is amazing, Dad. Look, we have HBO, we have Showtime. And my dad's face just changed, like instantly. He was like furious. Mm. And the reason why was because he knew he didn't pay for that, the premium package of cable, right? And so obviously the cable company was probably trying to ingratiate themselves with the mayor. So when, you know, he called right away and he's like, look, this is not what I paid for. I paid for basic cable and that's what I want. And that's what I'm going to get.
The only person in history ever to do that, probably.
Probably, but it was a great lesson for me that leadership and integrity and honesty is what you do when people aren't watching. It wasn't necessarily to teach me a life lesson. It certainly wasn't to make some sort of a political statement or anything. He just did it. And it was just things like that that stick with you. When you yourself get into public service and understand that you're going to be confronted with complicated situations where it's important for you to do the right thing.
You had this other moment when you were 20, right? When your dad runs again for mayor, he wins. And then he's removed from office due to some substantiated allegations of voter fraud.
Yep.
Now, your father was not found responsible for the fraud, but what did you learn from that whole incident?
Seeing my dad go through, you know, the ultimate highs of victory and success and also the lows of going through that that horrible process that he went through, right, where the election that he won was invalidated, and they basically threw out 4,500 votes because some people had voted inappropriately in the absentee ballot part of the race, and then just seeing his name trashed through the process, and it was hard to watch as a son, to be honest with you, and it definitely did not leave me with a good taste in my mouth about the idea of putting myself and subjecting myself to that process, to be honest. The question then is, why did I get into it, right? Like, how did it happen? I think subconsciously, at a deep level, his example and his life and the way he lived it, there's no doubt it influenced me tremendously, right?
Did you always think of yourself as a Republican?
I was and have been since I was 18, although some people would argue that I'm not. I get criticized for that sometimes, like not passing a purity test of some sort. I do think of myself as a very independent person, just generally thinking-wise. And I recall a saying that the mayor of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, former mayor Bill Peduto, he told me one day, you know, Mr. Mayor, in America, there are three parties. Well, there's Republicans. I said, yeah. He goes, there's Democrats. I said, yeah. And he goes, and there's mayors. You know, mayors take a different approach, right? Our approach is solve the problem. And we don't have the luxury of blaming other people or arguing about it or, you know, making it partisan.
You mentioned that sometimes people criticize you as not a real Republican, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Do they have a point? How loyal are you to the party? How much do you care about being a Republican?
Look, I think the entire system can be considered at times a bit of a fiction, right? In terms of the fact that, you know, they're trying to pigeonhole you as one thing or another as a way to define you. Because when you label somebody, it's easy to depersonalize them. It's easy to criticize them. It's easy to also to attack them, right? I believe in values that I think people would argue are conservative, right? Low taxes, right? Keeping people safe. Creating prosperity, right? You know, high-paying jobs, right? Those are, I think, fundamentally Republican values. I agree in a strong, you know, national defense and the fact that America should have a proper role, that it's the most democratizing and liberalizing force in the world. And that's coming from being the son of an immigrant, right? And I also believe, you know, that the American dream should be available to everybody, and that one of the things that we should fight for as a country is to make the dream available to more people. But there are some people that demonize the American dream a bit. If you're successful, you should feel guilty about it. And I don't necessarily agree with that.
You're a young, optimistic Cuban-American from Miami with time spent in city government. And, you know, there was someone like that in the 2016 Republican primary. His name was Marco Rubio, and he got absolutely flattened by Donald Trump. Do you think the Donald Trump era is over?
I think it remains to be seen. You know, he certainly tapped into something in 2016. I think in 2020, you know, the margin for victory, right? And if you look at the state-by-state margin, it was actually very short, very small.
Yeah, it was basically a tie both times.
Right. I think that means that this is the people struggling with these two choices. And the question is there a better choice? Is there a better path, right? And what is that path, right? I've often said that the 2024 election will be defined by four questions. Is it a boomer or is it a next generation candidate? Is it someone that has an inspirational, aspirational message, or is it a culture war starter, right? Someone who's divisive and wants to continue this divisive rhetoric that we're hearing. Is it someone that understands the inflection between the industrial economy and the ever-increasing digital economy and has a track record of building prosperity around that phenomenon, right? And question number four is it someone that can connect with the minority communities of this country, which are becoming larger and larger, right? Hispanics being one of them. They're one of the largest, not the largest minority group in the country. And is it someone that can connect with those people, right? And inspire them?
Do you have predictions for the midterms? What can we learn from what happens in the midterms?
I think the conventional wisdom is that Republicans will take back the House. What's interesting about a divided government scenario is that it will make the president and the country and both sides really have to come together to get anything done. It's going to have to be common sense, bipartisan legislation that gets passed.
One of the interesting things about where you are is you're there in Miami, in Florida, in the same state as perhaps the two most prominent Republicans in America, Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, neither of whom, as I understand, you voted for in the most recent elections. What's your relationship like with them?
I had really one interaction with the former president. I ran into him at a wedding. You know, I was happy to meet him. The person says, you know, Mr. President, this is the mayor of Miami. He goes, you're the only politician in America that's harder than I am. So I found that funny, and I found that to be magnanimous on his part. And stylistically very different from the governor. The governor's very, very serious and just has a totally different demeanor. Pretty much the only time that I've had any sort of conversation with him was during the pandemic at the beginning. He called me when I got COVID, and, you know, we had a couple of conversations around policy at that time. And then, you know, we sort of went our separate ways, and we haven't really reconnected since then.
Wait a second. You're the mayor of Miami. You've had issues. You've had hurricanes headed your way. And you're telling me that you're not in contact with the governor of your state?
Look, you know, I can't control what he does. You know, he's got to do things and lead the way he feels is best.
Interesting.
We did collaborate on $50 million of resiliency projects that were important for our city and were approved by the legislature. And we did a press conference together on that issue. And I think it's important because, as you know, adaptation and resiliency is a massive issue in Miami, particularly given these major storm events. Unfortunately, in the last 2 years, we've seen Mother Nature take it to the next level. We really, really need to collectively look at this problem comprehensively, all the way from the local government to state to the national government. With the infrastructure bill, to see how we get ahead of this.
I was going to say, were you excited about the climate change measures in Biden's Inflation Reduction Act?
Well, first of all, I don't think they're going to reduce inflation.
Well, that's just the name of it. I'm not describing it.
Telling you. No. I think naming something is interesting and important at times because bills get named and then renamed, right? You know, if you're gonna name something the climate bill, name it the climate bill, right? You know, there's a lot of good reason to invest in energy production. There's a lot of good reason to invest in resiliency, right? Things like that.
So you supported that bill?
No, I'm not saying I supported the bill. I think part of the problem with the federal government is that they have good ideas that cost a lot of money, but they don't often know how to pay for them.
So what would a Republican climate change agenda look like?
Well, I think you've got to recognize one thing. The first thing is all the studies show that for every dollar that you spend prophylactically, you save $7 to $8 post a storm. And the question is, what are we going to get from the infrastructure bill? I'd love to be able to see a percentage of the infrastructure bill come and leverage the state and local dollars that we've already spent.
One of the biggest changes in the Republican Party, you know, in the years since you first became mayor is the issue of immigration. And, you know, you had Republicans, especially in the 2000s, talking about maybe some sort of immigration grand bargain with Democrats. Now things have changed. How do you feel about that? And what do you think Republicans can or should or will do more generally on immigration?
Well, you referenced the early 2000s, and I don't even go back earlier than that. In the 80s, Republicans and President Reagan were also much more moderate on immigration. We've got to look at this issue, immigration, and talk about it coherently. And I don't think we are. I think everything is about the border. And both sides, by the way, in my opinion, are to blame for this. I think we've got to take a look at this issue from a legal immigration perspective because we're a country of laws and we all believe in the rule of law and what's in our best interest from a national security perspective and from an economic perspective. If you have a city like Miami, that's 1.4% unemployment. We need employees. I can tell you that right now.
Recently, you had the governor of your state using state money to relocate some asylum seekers from Texas to Martha's Vineyard. And for years, America had kind of an open-door policy for refugees from Cuba.
We did.
Should we be offering that same kind of welcome to refugees from Venezuela today?
Look, I do feel that we should treat Venezuelans the way we treat Cubans. And frankly, you know, they should get, at the very minimum right now, temporary protective status, at the very minimum. And by the way, it shouldn't be partisan. It should be something that's bipartisan, and both parties should agree to it.
When I hear you talk about immigration, you know, your perspective sounds like a perspective that I think a lot of voters would find refreshing. I also suspect that many of those voters are Democrats. and that for a lot of Democrats would love to see a Republican Party that was more like the Republican Party you're describing. But what makes you think that that's what Republican voters want?
I think leadership is, do you have the talent to articulate a message, a vision, and a plan to get people to a place where people will follow, even if maybe they're not so sure, maybe they're not that comfortable with it, but I trust this guy. You know, he makes a lot of sense. What he's saying, he's talking different. There's a different conversation. We're not even, in my opinion, we're not even having this conversation, right? And I think that's what's frustrating in both sides, right?
In April, you unveiled Miami's answer to New York's famous charging bull, the Bitcoin bull.
Yeah.
Since then, Bitcoin has lost about half its value. You think it's going to come back?
I thought you were going to ask me if I jinxed it.
I'm not blaming you, but I do want a prediction.
Oh, I appreciate that. No, listen, I do think Bitcoin has an opportunity to create a lot of good social change, democratizing wealth for a lot of people. And I think that also is crypto in nature when you think about fractionalized ownership and debt and equity, which I think will happen in our lifetime. The fundamental mathematics behind it, the inflationary component of it, what it can be used for, and how other policies are flailing in the face of an independent store of value currency system. The big issue right now, what's holding it up a lot, is regulation. And I think, you know, this winter, this crypto winter, people are building now. So that's what happens when times are tough, it's time to build, right? And then when times get good, you can grow.
And that's one thing I've realized. Miami has such a big reputation, and it's an influential city in its way. But it's relatively small, right? It's less than 500,000 people, roughly the size of Colorado Springs or Tulsa, Oklahoma. Your job is actually technically a part-time job. And so when I hear you talking about Miami, I hear you talking about it as if maybe the hope is, the idea is that this is just the beginning of your story.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I'm running $1.5 billion company in the city, right, with 4,500 employees and 4 labor unions. It's hard, right? It's challenging, but it's also fun and invigorating. You got to do something that challenges you and that gets you going and where you think you can make an impact. And so I think if I can do something that moves me, that helps me help other people's lives at a grander scale, you know, who knows? I mean, I think there's definitely things that interest me without a doubt. And I can tell you there's things that don't interest me. And I'm pretty definitive about those things.
Your father devoted his whole life to Miami politics. If you spent the rest of your life in Miami politics, would that be enough for you?
You're trying to get me in trouble, aren't you? like I either progress and do something that I feel is impactful at a greater scale, or I don't have a problem with going off into the sunset and, you know, being a private sector person, a professional, a parent, and a politician, I guess is the other P. But I don't have a problem losing one of those P's and focusing on the other P's.
Who's a better rapper, Trick Daddy or Trina?
Trina, for sure. I gave her the key to the city, so...
A nation of hip-hop fans thanks you for that, Mr. Mayor.
You got it.
That's Francis Suarez, mayor of the city of Miami. For the record, the mayor mentioned an unemployment figure of 1.4%, and that's a little outdated now, but the point stands, unemployment in Miami is very low. I'm Kelif Asane. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. We'll be back in a moment with Bono, lead singer of the band U2. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker. Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee. So, if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code RADIOHOUR at checkout for 15% off.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Kelefasene. Early in his career, Bono told an interviewer about his plans for his band, U2. If we stay in small clubs, we'll develop small minds, and then we'll start making small music, he said. That turned out not to be a problem. In the course of a decade, U2 went from playing local gigs in Dublin, Ireland, to being one of the biggest bands in the world. And Bono, the fearless and sometimes shameless leader, became the definitive rock star of the modern era, conquering arenas and stadiums around the globe, singing out and often holding forth, too. Bono just wrote a memoir called Surrender. He joined David Remnick at the New Yorker Festival earlier this month.
When you talk to people who have been in bands when they're 16, no matter what their destiny was, they have no expectations other than to play in a bar, to maybe be the best blues band in London, like the Stones, or whatever. What was the ambition that was fired up in you pretty quickly once this band sort of took shape?
Megalomania started in me at a very early age, David. And the other part of it is desperation and the sense that, you know, from my point of view, this was liberation for me. And I had known as a child that I had melodies in my head and, you know, here and there I'd be good at school, but I was losing concentration and more interested in girls and then music and then, oh, music and girls. and a release from a kind of the pain that a lot of people feel when they don't know what it is that they might have to offer. When I sang in U2, something got a hold of me and it made sense of me. Yeah.
Do you think that some of that feeling, some of that passion came from the loss that you had suffered 2 years before? Your mother died at her own father's funeral. Or fell ill, certainly fell ill, and then died soon thereafter. Eerily, strangely, this is a loss at the same age that Paul McCartney, I think Johnny Lydon, mm-hmm. Bob Geldof, John Lennon's mother died very early. What was in you from that loss, and then a household of three guys, your brother and your father? It seemed there was a great emptiness after that.
It's funny that thing about rock and roll singers and the mother. I heard somebody say in hip hop, it's more the father. It's interesting. I don't know if that's true or not, but they're both about abandonment. And, you know, the heart of the blues, for me, it turned into a gift. This wound in me just turned into this opening where I had to fill the hole with music. And it's a very unscientific theory I have. If someone you love's passing, there's sometimes a gift. And the opening up of music came from my mother. And when my father passed, I finally became, I came into a different kind of voice. My father used to say, "You're a baritone. Who thinks he's a tenor?" And I sort of, after my father died, I felt I kind of became the tenor.
What do you think of that analysis of your voice, a baritone who thinks he's a tenor?
Very accurate. My father was quite accurate.
Quite
he had
was.
Me down.
And loved opera himself.
Yeah, he did. He was a tenor. And pretty good tenor. And yeah, it's interesting. You think about working class, Dublin, city centre Dublin, Catholic, loved, his mother used to listen to the cricket scores on the radio, like in England, and he listened to opera, they read. It's interesting, I like the fact that when people don't fit into their box, my father didn't fit into the box, and then just round the corner my mother lived, she was a Protestant, and they fell in love with each other. Not remarkable in these days, but in a time when Ireland was nearly at civil war, it became a big thing.
Tell me about, though, your memories of that sectarian violence and the way it fed into your art that was beginning, your music.
Developed a distrust of religion, very suspicious of religion. I still am. You know, you see what's going on in Iran, for instance, today. It's very male, isn't it, this religious violence. And even going back to when I was growing up, you know, it was very male, that energy. And my father was also suspicious of kind of nationalism. My father used to say things like, you know, he'd quote O'Casey. You say, that line from O'Casey, you know, "What is Ireland but the only the land that keeps my feet from getting wet?" And when I was writing the book, I found out O'Casey never wrote that. No, he made that up. He really did. It's a great line, though, isn't it?
It is a great line. Your title is Surrender. It's a motif that runs throughout the book. Why did you name the book Surrender?
It's a word I am still grappling with. I'm kind of gathering around it. It doesn't come natural to me.
How do you mean?
I find it, you know, I was kind of born with my fists up, metaphorically speaking. Sometimes, literally.
You describe yourself as an angry guy right off the...
A little bit. Yeah. It's not even that. Just a bit a bit defensive, maybe, and just have my fists up. And so the word surrender doesn't come natural to me. Or a lot of Irish people growing up in the 70s. I still find it hard, you know, to surrender to my bandmates. As an older person, as you, it gets even harder to surrender to my wife, you know, to surrender to my maker. I'm quite a defiant character, but I'm working on that, David. And that's why I wrote the book.
And that's why we're here.
I'm here, yes. My mother dropped me on my head when I was a baby.
An incredible fraternity and friendship and creative ferment develops in the band, and yet you describe more than once how the band almost breaks up. There's an early...
Only on the good albums.
Yeah. And there's one moment that I wish you'd talk about, that where Edge has a kind of spiritual crisis. And he's going to leave, and then if he's going to leave, you're going to leave, and the whole thing seems ready to just dissipate in a moment's time. What happened? It's in the book, I swear to God.
Is tonight a Friday night? It's more of a Sunday morning story, but I will answer that question.
Thank you.
So we're in a non-denominational school. They're not pushing religion down our throats. And yet, three of us end up with this very deep faith. We're touched by some of the people we meet at a deep level. And we start reading the sacred texts. We start exploring this. We meet these, I suppose you'd call them first century radical Christians, kind of punks. And, you know, they didn't need many material things. They were very strict in that sense. But they were kind of interesting. And at first we thought that they accepted us for being who we were. But after a while, they started to get in at us. Maybe this music thing is, you should just put that down. And if, you know, the world is broken, really. And it's really broken. And if you want to be part of the fixing of it, maybe music is something you should just put away and sing these praise songs. So I'm like, every song we sing is a praise song. What is the story on this? And I can't do the happy clappy. I think God might object to being patronized. And lovely, brilliant, isn't he brilliant? Now,
you figure God already knows.
I think God knows, but I'll tell you what, I'm into worship, and I do believe in worship. And the worship, even if it starts with brilliant, if you get to the brilliance, ooh, well, that's something. So anyway, we're kind of going, we're believing these people. Maybe we're wrong. And Edge is feeling it really badly. He's in a kind of agony, actually. And he rings me up and he says, I don't think I can resolve this. And so I said, well, yeah, I'm having some problems with this too. I want to be useful. I want to be useful in my life. I want to have my life to add up to something, and I want our life to add up to something. I want to be useful to the world. The world is, you know, fucked. They didn't like you saying fucked, but that's how we spoke. But I said, okay, we'll agree. I'll leave. And then Larry was like the same. And then Adam, again, all he ever wanted. And he's like, oh God. and Adam had introduced us to a quite posh manager called Paul McGuinness. And we just had success with our first album called Boy. And we'd go and tell him that it was all over. So he was sitting there and we walked in and Paul... So you've been speaking to God. And we're like, yeah. And God has told you that you don't want to be in the band again. You want to break up the band. Said, well, in a manner of speaking, yes. Okay. So you've been speaking to God and he doesn't want you to be in a band. And how's God on legal contracts? Because I've signed a legal contract here And we were just, you know, just completely, oh, maybe we didn't hear that right. And anyway, so we went back on the road and we played the October tour and it was pretty special, but Edge still wasn't resolved. And he was trying to figure out how could we make our music a useful in the more profound sense. And Ali and I got married and I went away to Jamaica. Chris Blackwell gave us GoldenEye, this place that he, and we were like, whoa. We didn't have much cash to speak on, so this was incredible. And this was the land of Bob Marley. And Bob Marley played a role in our life, though I would never meet him. And here's what it was. Edge, whilst we're away, starts to work on a song that will really explain, will solve the problem. And the song was called Sunday Bloody Sunday. And he starts it off. But if you hear it, you'll hear it, the Jamaican influence. So, I can't believe the news today. I can't close my eyes. All on their way, how long? And you realize that the reason why Chris Blackwell didn't throw us off Island Records, because we'd made a mad religious album, wasn't mad at all. But people were calling it mad. He was used to dealing with Bob Marley. And Bob Marley wanted to sing to God. Bob Marley wanted to sing to girls. Bob Marley wanted to sing to the world around him and protest it. So there it was, a three-chord strand that became U2. And that started with Edge and Sunday Bloody Sunday.
Bono spoke with David Remnick at the New Yorker Festival. Their conversation continues in just a minute. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Kelefasene. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Kelefasene, sitting in today for David Remnick. We're returning now to David's interview with Bono, the lead singer of U2. Bono just wrote a memoir, Surrender, about his life and his time in U2. One of the things David and Bono talked about is the band's early hit Sunday Bloody Sunday. The lyrics refer to a 1972 massacre in Northern Ireland when protesters were killed by British soldiers. But Bono insists on the song's non-sectarian message. He says it was a condemnation of violence on all sides of the conflict. Here's David Remnick talking with Bono.
It's such an interesting song in so many ways, and such a wonderful song. And it was also something that was a little complicated for you politically, for the public. You would say, you described it once as, for unionists, it was a betrayal. For nationalists, It was an ad campaign. What was the political line that you were trying to tread with Sunday Bloody Sunday?
I mean, yeah, it was an odd song because we were trying to contrast this bloody event in Irish history with Christ on the cross and the kind of stupidity of religious violence. And you know, but we were like 22 and feeling this in our country. And at first people got excited. Some of the Republicans were like putting up the war album and the posters around Good Man. And the unionists were like, ooh. And then they swapped. And it was like, no, they're not for the war. And it was like, oh, and it, we didn't know which side we were on. And then I started to dismantle the Irish flag on stage. I would tear off the gold and then tear off the green and just hold up the white. And these were sort of dramatic acts I learned from, I suppose, studying John Lennon, whatever. But these were powerful acts. And then, through reading about the civil rights in these United States and reading about Dr. King, then I started to understand more about nonviolence. And we went into New Year's Day, we went into a whole, this vein, just a very rich vein in songwriting. But it did, in Dublin there was, and not in Dublin, but around the country, suddenly it wasn't as, it just wasn't as cool to be into U2. We weren't so much the national team in certain areas.
But you would preface the song and performance by saying, this is not a rebel song. Was that alienating to some?
Yes.
And how did you feel it? How did that alienation or rejection or opposition make itself known?
I remember being in a car coming out of one of our concerts in Croke Park, and our car was surrounded, and I just dismantled the flag, and there were some angry people around the car, and they were trying to smash the window where Ali was sitting with me. And I remember thinking, that was wow. And you feel the pain of these people. Now I understand the real pain people were in. And I wish not to make light of it. I think you can die for your ideals, but you shouldn't kill for them, if at all. But I understand that these people felt they were at a war, and that I had betrayed them, and our band was betraying them.
You recently appeared, as you do so often in these situations, in Kyiv, in Ukraine.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw you, I believe you were in a metro station, a subway station, and met with politicians. What do you find yourself achieving when you do that? Tell me about your experience in Ukraine.
So it goes back to Sunday, Bloody Sunday. It goes back to charity is a thing that we all are part of. But justice is something that really is a reason for me to get out of bed. And the injustice of what's happening in Ukraine was so hard to take that we just wanted people to know that we were with them. And I'd met President Zelensky before he was president. Met him in Ukraine. He's a great storyteller. I mean, you know this. And he's an actor. He's one of us. You know what I mean? Yermak, his right hand, is a film producer. They're storytellers. They need to get their story out, which is why they're doing all this media, because they know if the if they disappear from your phones, if they disappear from your screens, then they mightn't get the money from the United States. So when President Zelensky asked us to go, I had to go. And Edge wanted to go, and there was lots of musicians. I remember Bob Geldof wanted to go. We all wanted to go, but in the end, it was the two of us busking in a sort of in a subway. But you know what's interesting? When I saw it back, they lit it really well. I'm like, they're in a war, and they're like, no. You know what to do here to make this look. Bono, you need to look good. You're going to the race. It's like, what? And but it's just, yeah, these are incredible people. And they love freedom. And they love it so much, they're ready to lay down their life for freedom. And we who live in freedom should really, really remember not to fall asleep in ours.
Bono, I should say I came here several hours ago and people had been lined up outside. They were very eager to ask you questions. And one that I kept hearing was, did you find writing a memoir therapeutic in any way? What was the motivation to do so?
The gift it gave me was time on my own. And it turns out I need more time on my own. And it changed me, actually. I don't know if it's changed me for well. I don't go out as much. And also, I'm such a shy typist that when I talk too quickly and I sort of throw the paint at the canvas. But when I'm typing, I have to slow down my thoughts and make more. They make more sense of me and I make more sense of them.
This is a wonderful question. You and Ali recently celebrated 40 years of marriage. He's here tonight. This is great. This is terrific. An Irish newlywed in the audience asks, what's the secret?
A newlywed in the audience. It's quite mad getting married.
Yeah, I know.
There's a grand madness about it. And there's some... There's something about that, and knowing that you're going against the odds. But I would say, if you're asking me seriously, that friendship can outpace romantic love sometimes. And, you know, friendship is what myself and Ali have. We have when you have romantic love and friendship, that's really something special. But I don't want to give you the impression that everything was all easy for us. But any time either of us got lost, the other would be there to get the other one home. And I'm so grateful. And it was brilliant when we got to 40 and we went, let's not fuck this up now. I mean, you know.
A related question. The other relationship that's 40 years old, we just had the documentary, the Get Back documentary, and we watched the Beatles in rehearsal.
Brilliant.
And anybody who was in a band said, it's amazing, they're so creative, they're getting along so well. And then anybody else who's not in a band thought, they hate each other, they're not getting along at all. When you watched that documentary, how did you relate it to your 40 years in a band? This band has outlasted the Beatles by a factor of four.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it. Get Back, if you haven't seen it. First of all, who knew the Beatles invented reality TV? That was mad. Like they had little, you know, little microphones in the flower pots, and they're over there. John's talking like this, and they're giving out fucking hell. And they had it all wired. So they invented reality TV. Second thing was like watching Jesus, like on the, you know, the Beatitudes or something. And it was, you know, you can imagine, it's like...
drafting the Beatitudes.
And the weak will inherit the earth, and the meek will inherit the earth. No. The sick, you know, you could see them actually doing it. I couldn't believe it. But yeah, you could feel the tension. It's very hard for males, and it gets harder to move around each other the older you get. But males are funny, especially, I think women are better at this, but, you know, I could see it in the Beatles. And I should tell you just a tiny little story that Paul told me, which is brilliant. Like, I hang out with Paul all the time. I don't. But let me tell you, when I do, I pay attention. Because it's like hanging out with Johann Sebastian Bach. I would carry his guitar case, and no question about it. But he was talking about his relationship, and he says, you know, it could be really overbearing. I realized. And he says, you know, I was going at John one day. I was going at him, you know. And he just looked up, and actually, he was wearing glasses just like you. No kidding. And he just did this. He went, hey, Paul. It's just me, it's John. It's only me, it's John. And he said, trying to calm me down, he was. But bands go at each other. And we, you know, but again, it's friendship. It has to be friendship. And that's the thing that has kept you two together.
But you did something very unusual for a band in that you split everything up financially. Equally.
What a fool. What a fool. Didn't think you would add up to anything.
Yeah.
No, it's the best thing ever. And those songs are made what they are because of Edge, Adam, and Larry. And our manager used to say to us, you know, it's not musical differences that break up most bands. It's the moolah. And he said, get that right. And other crackers like, don't be the band who looks too stupid to enjoy being at number one. Smile, for God's sake.
Bono's new memoir is called Surrender. He talked with my boss, David Remnick, at the New Yorker Festival this month. David's going to be back next week, and I hope you will be too. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Kella Fasene. Thanks for joining us.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Gofen Mputubwele.
Along with Jeffrey Masters, Will Coley, Jenny Lawton, and Michael May. And we had assistance from Harrison Keithline and James Napoli, with help this week from Justin Treguer. And special thanks to Catherine Sterling, Amanda Miller, Nico Brown, and Michael Etherington.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.